Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, land of the free and home of the just plain weird. We'll get a peek inside the drifting lives of today's hobos with a journalist and free spirit who rode the rails to the annual hobo convention in Britt, Iowa. We'll also preview a proposed reality TV show that follows Hasidic Jews who leave their enclaves for mainstream urban life. And 40 years after Free to Be You and Me, a new collection of essays reflects on the 1970s phenomenon that forever changed the way we think about girls, boys, parents, and toys. But first, the United States of Icky. The Statue of Liberty, the Grand Canyon, Disneyland, all among the American landmarks that project the beautiful and majestic aspects of our nation. Richard Falk is more curious about American oddities. His American road trip would include the Spam Museum in Austin, Texas, or Layla's Hair Museum in Missouri. Richard is a freelance writer and editor and author of Gross America, your coast-to-coast guide of all things gross. Richard, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
It's, how can I help but say gross? There's something gross. There's something
well,
grody
you.
To the max about this.
I'm glad you're speaking my native California idiom. Yeah.
So what was your criteria when setting out on your road trip of American grossness?
Well, kind of like pornography. I think I knew the gross when I saw it. I did have standards, but I think I did violate them all the time as well. But basically, anytime somebody's insides ended up on the outside, that was valid criteria. That's gross. And then I did try to look for some kind of monstrous insects and crazy wildlife. So
no better lead into one of my favorite sounding attractions. Well, there are a number of intestinally related items, which I guess just generally gross, but not the least of which is the intestinal tract model. Now, this is at the Amazing Body Pavilion in Houston. It's large enough to walk through. Tell me about the experience of walking through a giant intestine.
Right. Well, that's at the Health Museum. It's pretty light gross. It's very kid-friendly. They make it for even toddlers, so it's even less frightening than some of my earliest experiences I remember at Disneyland. So it's, as I call it in the book, it's your child's gateway to the gross. So it's kind of a Lego-colored, you know, Tinker Toy-looking sort of pavilion, very stylized. There's a big spine that forms the dome at the top of the building, and you can look through an enormous eyeball window. It's very cute.
It's an adorable intestine.
It's an adorable intestine.
Also in Houston, the Civil War battlefield embalming diorama. I mean, this is one of those who knew. How did you find these things?
Absolutely. Well, this one I'd searched around for. I have friends that they're really into these museums, but no one had found this one before. Apparently, though, it's very popular, and it's been voted the best attraction in the area for a few years in a row. It's part of the Museum of Funeral History, and it's actually not a morbid place at all. It's by sort of professional undertakers who take a professional pride in what they do. So I had to dig deep to find the gross here, and that was the full-size Civil War embalming attraction. There's no way you can think about embalming at all without getting into the gross. But, you know, it's a really interesting story about how that came. Basically, through the Civil War, that's when Americans decided they needed to embalm people because so many people were dying in war far away from home, and families wanted them one last time to say goodbye. And that's what got people over their horror of embalming. Everyone wanted it suddenly.
I know we've mentioned two from Texas and Houston even, which is interesting, but it doesn't have the monopoly on icky stuff, not even regionally. Which part of the country does have the highest concentration of gross sites?
Well, it gives me great pleasure to say you guys.
No kidding. Well, that's good to know.
The East Coast is very rich, although I do have to say New England is almost gross-free. I saw a lot of things in Boston. I'm sure there's a lot there. I just think you New Englanders like to, you know, keep your cards close to the vest.
Well, certainly, one place that you mention a lot is the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia. It was an actual, you know, teaching medical museum in the mid-19th century. It was called a pathological cabinet. It's a place where they collected interesting pathological specimens. You know, this is before, obviously, before the internet, where you could go online and look at movies of sick people, look at 3D models. So to hone your medical skills, you had to go see the real things up close. So they have entire brains, entire organs that are preserved in glass jars of formaldehyde. They have skulls. They have skeletons. all these sorts of, you know, curious medical abnormalities that physicians would go and study. And I have to say, it's about 100 years old, but it's a beautiful dark wood and brass, kind of Jules Verne-looking place, very beautiful and tranquil. And behind the glass walls are just the most horrific specimens of human ailment and abnormality.
I guess I'm trying to figure out, I mean, all the places that we've mentioned have a certain appeal for a 12-year-old kid, but there seems to be this connection between science and grossness. And I don't know, has that always been there?
I think so. I mean, I'll put it this way. The things that interest me the most about the gross are the things that have a little bit of an interesting background. Sometimes that's just a strange anecdote. For example, the world's best artificial vomit manufacturer is right here in Chicago. So I do have very kind of silly and fun things. I don't have a huge capacity for being grossed out, honestly. So I'm not the kind of guy who can just stare at a jarred fetus for hours at a time. Some people can. What I try to take from that situation is, why am I here? What's compelling me to look at it? And why would anyone want to do this? And that comes up, you know, mostly in these medical contexts. You know, there's a whole 100, maybe thousands of years history that leads up to that point of a pickled fetus that you're looking at, you know. And I think it's the backstory that appeals to me.
We're speaking with Richard Falk. He's the author of a book called Gross America, Your Coast-to-Coast Guide to All Things Gross, which includes fetuses in jars, as you mentioned, frozen dead guys, candy-coated insects, the world's only poop-fueled street lamp, and so much more. Poop-fueled street lamp, that's in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yeah, that's a good one. It's a project of a guy who's sort of half artist, half green evangelist, if you want to call him that. It's a guerrilla art project almost that he put in a dog park. There's a machine that's called by the lovely name a digester, which you bury underground, and it's got the right chemical mixture in there that when you put dog poop in there, it breaks it down really quickly and releases the methane and, you know, other combustible gases that you can burn to generate electricity. Actually, we're behind the curve here in the States. Something like this wouldn't raise any eyebrows in India or China. It's even a lot more common in the Scandinavian countries to recycle poop this way. So he's trying to get the word out to us Americans.
Do you have a favorite place, Richard, that you visited?
Well, I think for the Bay Area, I should put out a shout-out for the tarantula trek. That's something that just wrapped up. The weekend before Halloween was the last weekend. But there's a hill not far outside of Berkeley here that is home to lots of tarantulas. And the Halloween season is the time they come out to breed. So it's this perfect confluence of nature and Halloween. At this time, the park rangers have these evening tarantula treks where whole families come out with their flashlights and they look for the tarantula men trying to get it on with the tarantula women all across this lovely Northern California golden hillside.
How about the grossest place in America?
I think one of the grossest things and one of the most fascinating for me is the soap. Well, there's a soap man and a soap lady.
What's a soap man or a lady? I'm sorry.
Believe it or not, soap is just a particular form of fat. And so when you die, if you've got the right chemical conditions, your fat can spontaneously turn to soap, which is something that I've never heard of before.
My goodness.
So it takes a good fat person. It takes an airless environment, a little bit of water, a little bit of alkali, and there you go. But you look at these people, and they kind of look like maybe they've been sculpted out of clay. They look a little bit like a mummy with the bandages removed. So it's not really, it's not horrifying. It's just a little weird to look at. But then you see that they're kind of this ochre golden color, and you soon realize that that's all fat that's turned to soap. And this, for me, is just a perfect example of just the bizarre things a human body can do that's gross. But your curiosity trumps any sort of visceral horror, and you just want to know, how can this happen?
I'm not sure I'm at the curiosity stage yet. Well,
it takes a while. You got to build up calluses. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Richard. It's just a fascinating book, and I appreciate your time today.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me. It was a great time.
Richard Falk, a freelance writer and editor and author of Gross America, Your Coast to Coast of All Things Gross. He's grossed us out today, and he'll do it for you. You can look online and find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, a reporter heeds the call of the open road and rails and sets out for the National Hobo Convention. We'll talk with him about what he found there when Word of Mouth continues. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. There is something keenly American about riding the rails. We meet kind-hearted hobos in Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, hear the restless spirit in Woody Guthrie songs, and cheer on Chaplin's Little Tramp striking out for the Yukon. The lives of real hobos don't sound nearly so romantic, especially today when their numbers are few and rail security is fierce. Since 1900, many of those who can make their way to Britt, Iowa for the annual National Hobo Convention. Aaron Lake Smith is senior editor of Vice magazine, where he wrote about hitching his own ride to Britt and his experience there, which led him to wonder if the American hobo has reached the end of the line. Aaron Lake Smith, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You hopped your first train with a friend at 18, following a ragged, hand-drawn map, and that was the first time of many. What was it that hooked you?
To start with, I guess it was dangerous, which always makes you feel alive. So, I mean, we got on the train, and you get going, and you get to see kind of the backside of this world that you're used to seeing from roads. I mean, I went through my home state of North Carolina and got to see all these cities from kind of the dirt backyards and away from the kind of the highways and civilization. So, I mean, you kind of get out there and you really just, you get to see this world, this kind of hidden, unusual world that we're not used to seeing in kind of day-to-day life. You know, you just get hooked. You get hooked to kind of the adrenaline rush of it almost.
There is a kind of pioneering, searching romanticism in the image, I think. And many people bought it out of necessity or maybe a wish for freedom. About a million people on the road as hobos between 1890 and 1930. 48,000 killed in 10 years, 1898 to 1908. A pretty perilous way of life, which brings us really to Britt, Iowa, offering itself as a host of the Hobo Convention in 1900. Now, why did Britt, this town, welcome people otherwise discarded as troublesome or vagrants?
Yeah, I felt like that was the most interesting part of the story almost, in that, you know, Britt was this newly incorporated farming community, and they were kind of out looking to make a name for themselves, and where most of the other communities all across the country were saying, you know, they had vagrant laws on the books, and they were trying to kind of get rid of the hobos, kind of treating them as this undesirable element. Britt said, you know what, we need temporary farm workers, we need a population, and they basically got in touch with the hobos at that time. Invited them down, you know, actually brought them down in a passenger train, kind of courted them, showed them the town, said, here's, you know, we can have this space for you. This is a place where you guys can meet for forever. And the hobos took them up on it. And since then, it's, you know, 112 years, hobos have been coming to Britt.
Well, back in the day, I guess hobo conventions were a place where people could pass on knowledge, you know, train schedules, train lines, friendly people. What do they do now at the National Hobo Convention?
Well, now, I mean, the way I described in my piece is it's more county fair mainstream. It's just not quite as rugged and outlaw as you might imagine. I mean, it, definitely the population's age. People are retired. They're older. People have campers now. They're coming in cars. It's an entirely kind of different vibe than you might expect from, you know, some of the earlier descriptions of the hobo conventions, the turn of the century. It was a really wild kind of raucous event, an event you didn't want to bring children to. And today there was, you know, there's tons of kids at the hobo convention. There's townspeople coming to kind of look at the festivities and the parade and try out Mulligan stew, which is kind of the ancestral, the meal of the hobo, which is just, pretty much a number of vegetables and meat kind of chopped up in these big vats and cooked up and served up in these little styrofoam cups.
You know, it's funny to consider the hobo as a tourist attraction. I was reading another article about the convention on, I think it was BuzzFeed, and the author noted how many people actually fall into fires. I mean, I'm looking at photographs that you have on Vice. Some hard-worn lives, you know, ragged-looking, nicotine-stained, a lot of drinking and drugs. And if we look at regular homeless figures and their statistics on drinking, drug abuse, mental illness, is it the same case for hobos? Is it a different population?
I think it is. I think, you know, the hobos, it's, they're kind of considered, I mean, there's kind of this whole taxonomy. There's hobos, which are kind of at the top of the hierarchy, and there's tramps, and then below them are bums. And so I think, you know, the hobos were, they have a dignity. It's kind of a quiet dignity and a desire to work and a desire to really be part of, be respectful, be responsible. And they kind of consider themselves, you know, the good, you know, the good people, the good homeless almost. They don't kind of put themselves in that category, even though, you know, drinking and drugs, I feel like on trains and on, if you're traveling, I feel like that's just a part of the lifestyle. You have so much free time. You're kind of rambling around. I mean, you inevitably want to crack open a bottle of wine or some beer. So I feel like
or whatever.
It's just you have so much time and you're wandering the country, and I think that's a part of it, rather than, you know, obviously addiction plays a part, but I don't think it's as bad as kind of traditional homeless population.
We're talking with Aaron Lake Smith. He's senior editor of Vice magazine, where he wrote about attending the National Hobo Convention in an article called "Death of the American Hobo: The National Hobo Convention Reaches the End of the Line." Not an optimistic title, Aaron. Why is the way of life coming to an end?
Well, you know, at the Hobo Convention, you mostly had senior citizens. I mean, this is a group, the people that actually call themselves hobos are sick and they're getting old, and they're kind of, they really are, you know, most of them can't ride trains anymore. They've settled down. It's the actual title of hobo is something that I think is dying off. You have these younger populations, you have travelers, you have people like me who, you know, might do it for adventure, might do it to get a free ride or for whatever reasons, but I think it's rare that you'll find a really young person calling themselves a hobo, and it is a kind of special designation. I mean, the hobo, it was a part of American life. You know, there's a million hobos on the rails back in the day, back in the early turn of the century, and they became a part of communities. They were farm workers. They were migrant labor. There was some respect, and I think today there's so few, and it's a more outsider kind of way of life. That kind of dignity is fading away, and it's kind of fragmenting into a million different pieces.
Well, you're a young man yourself. You rode the rails to get there, dodging the authorities for a bit before being warned off in, I think, Wyoming. You then rented a U-Haul and picked up some hitchhikers. Now, two of those hitchhikers kind of illustrate to me the old hobo and the new hobo, Joe and Alex. Tell us a little bit about them and why they are on the road.
Joe was this, you know, basically we were driving through Wyoming in our U-Haul, and we saw this guy with, you know, a 2-foot beard pushing his bicycle, which is like loaded down with 400 pounds of supplies up this hill. And so we decided to pick him up, and, you know, we were kind of feeling each other out. But once he got going with us, you know, I saw that he really was this kind of mythological American figure. I mean, he was probably 55 years old. He looked like he was going on 70, missing teeth. But, I mean, he was this kind of Paul Bunyan, Rip Van Winkle, living this life that none of us could really believe. He'd been camping out for 10 years. Mm-hmm. He was riding his bike to Arkansas to go panning for gold. He was talking to animals. And, you know, very, very lucid man, very cogent man, smart guy who'd been kind of living this way of life outside of the bounds of society. And Alex was kind of his opposite, actually. You know, Alex was, you know, 29 years old, former Google employee who was, you know, using couchsurfing.org and had kind of been traveling and hitchhiking for 2 years and, you know, very, you know, had an iPhone, very modern traveler, and was the younger generation and not quite the same level of commitment. It's more like he was doing it for an adventure and kind of fun and just enjoying his life and getting to see the country.
You write also about a tramp fest. This is an offshoot of those who, you know, look at the, I don't know, the hippie craft fair of the modern National Hobo Fest and have kind of create what you call a younger, drunker, and stabbier version. Well, tell us about this new tattooed, pierced, free spirit anarchist. Are they coming up to assume the role of the hobo?
Right. I think that's kind of what I was trying to explore in the piece, because I feel like I'm familiar with this kind of outsider young people who are traveling and, you know, riding trains across the country. I think they are kind of the inheritors in some way of the hobo tradition, but it's different. It's not quite as unified. It's more of a lifestyle where, you know, you get the impression reading documents and doing research that the hobo was more of an American social movement almost. And it was, you know, they were workers. They were a union. The hobos had a union, and they were this unemployed union, and they were card carrying, and they kind of ended up building the base of a lot of, you know, progressive kind of ideas here in this country. And they were doing this, you know, traveling around, kind of carrying their ideas from place to place.
I want to thank you, Aaron, so much for sharing your experience with us.
Thank you.
Aaron Lakesmith, senior editor of Vice Magazine, where we found his article, Death of the American Hobo. The National Hobo Convention reaches the end of the line. You'll find a link to the article along with some great photographs and a video from the National Hobo Convention. The links are at wordofmouthradio.org. And you can, of course, post your thoughts on this and anything else you hear at our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio, or on Twitter, at Word of Mouth.
You can watch my jumper, watch my overhaul. Catch a train they call the Cannonball from Buffalo to Washington.
Coming up, America's Unchosen Ones, a reality show concept that follows ex-Hasidic Jews making their way in the big city, embracing dating, pop culture, and yes, even bacon. We'll hear that story when Word of Mouth continues.
Yonder comes a train coming down the track.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Take a flip through the channels and you'll find a reality TV show covering just about every population, compulsion, or income bracket. A few months ago, we found out about a new reality concept being developed by No Regrets Entertainment. The show proposed to follow four former Orthodox Jews as they made their way in secular New York City. Brad Rothschild is one of the producers behind the tentatively titled show, Shunned. Brad, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
Also with us is Luza Twersky, one of the potential cast members for the show. Luza, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
Luza, you have to spell that for us because that's not a stage name, right?
No, it's not. It's my given name. It's the name I was born with. It's spelled L-U-Z-E-R.
So how did they pronounce it when you were growing up?
Loser.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a Hebrew name that kind of got lost in translation in the past 300 years when Yiddish was invented.
So give us a little background on what it was like to grow up Hasidic, where you grew up in New York.
I grew up in New York City, yes. I'm a stone's throw from Manhattan, but a world away. I mean, it's basically you grow up without television or movies or newspapers or, you know, all these interesting kinds of foods. It's a very sheltered world. As a child and even as a teenager, you kind of think that nothing else exists. You know, you're afraid of non-Jews. You think all non-Jews want to kill you, and you think all non-Jews hate you, and all the people who live out there are basically terrible people, a bunch of murderers and rapists, and that the whole secular world is one big orgy, you know. And it's, mm-hmm. The view of the secular world of the goyim, which is Gentiles, yeah, is basically that, you know, they're just all bad and they have no morals.
But it must have held some attraction for you because you left.
Well, it holds attraction to everyone, you know. It looks like fun from the outside, at least. And it is fun, you know, being on the inside of the outside now. But from that viewpoint, you know, it's flashy. It looks flashy.
Mm. So following you is part of the topic or the subject of Shunned or The Chosen One. I've seen a couple of different working titles. Brad, this, of course, is going to make for very interesting reality TV. I mean, how did you come into the picture with this concept?
Well, I'm working with Noah Scheinman, another producer who's at No Regrets Entertainment, and we were actually researching another project. And I came across a website called Unpious, which is edited by somebody named Shulam Dean. It's really a website that's called Voices on the Hasidic Fringe. And I started reading some articles written by people who are in the Hasidic world, not anymore in the Hasidic world, somewhat related to the Hasidic world. And I started really getting pulled in further and further. And I sent an email to Shulam Dean, and we met each other a few times, and we started talking. And from those conversations, it occurred to me that this would be a very interesting universe to look into.
Was it a concept first and then you did auditions for people? Or how did you find people like Loser, for example? And there are three other cast members now, I think.
Well, there are several other cast members that we're not locked into a certain number yet. We've spoken with a few people. There are a couple people, one of whom her family does not yet know that she is out of the community. So we're trying to keep her under wraps a little bit just for her own sake. But actually, Shulam Dean is the one who helped identify a lot of these characters for us, or a lot of these potential characters for us. He introduced us to Loser. He introduced us to a few other people based on some parameters that he and I discussed about what type of people we were looking for.
Well, Loser, there's a picture of you. I think it's you in the New York Daily News.
I know where this is going.
You're wearing a hat. You've got a long, you know, full beard and payas, those kind of curly Q things on the side of your head. And you're lasciviously eyeing a packet of bacon. I mean, so is this show, is it sort of a comedic show? Is that what we're going for here?
Well, I don't know. That you're going to have to ask Brad that question, what the show is exactly going to be. That photo, I mean, when I first had bacon, I actually did an interview. My story was broadcast on NPR before and was produced by a guy named Josh Gleason. And at some point, we were doing some interviews at his apartment, and he was making bacon. And I hadn't had bacon before that. And he asked me, you know, would you like to taste it? And I'm like, yeah, I don't know. Is God going to strike me dead? Well, let's give it a shot. So I took that first bite, and I was like, oh, God, this is so good. So I kind of like fell in love with bacon. I know it's kind of become what I've been known for. I mean, except there's a lot more to me than just loving bacon. But I'm also an actor. So when I did my headshots, I was working with this really, really quirky photographer. And we were talking and chatting. He's like, hey, why don't we do a bacon shot? That one, I guess I posted it on my Facebook and I went a little crazy from there. And it just happened to fit because I quote bacon a lot.
I'm sorry, that's really Loser's shtick. But the show is not going to be a comedic look at people's lives, people who have left the community. And, you know, I want to be clear that we're not out to disparage the Hasidic world or anybody still in it.
You're not, you mean?
We are not.
You're not.
I'm just kidding.
Well, what's the distinction here? I mean, that's part of the thing. With a reality program, you kind of want tension. You kind of want conflict. You want exciting things to happen in people's lives. So, Brad, you as a producer, looking at Loser's life and these other subjects, whoever they may come to be, you know, there is a little bit of tension, I suppose, between the producers and the people who are living it.
Well, certainly what makes for compelling TV or film or anything is drama and tension. You're right. Really, what makes this compelling for us is the universality of the idea. These are a bunch of young people who are struggling with the same things that young people all over the world are struggling with. They're trying to establish themselves personally, professionally, relationships. What's different about these guys is that, as one of them has described it, it's almost as if they were plunked down on this planet from Mars, and they just don't have the same information and necessarily coping ability to deal with the modern world that they're now a part of.
Well, Loser, you just called to mind that idea of, like, were you prepared to live in this world, to be plunked down from another planet, as Brad put it? Did you know about popular culture at all? You were recently divorced. I guess you were quite young when you were first originally married. Tell us how you made your way.
No, I didn't grow up with any popular culture. In fact, the first script I got as an actor was a line where my character mentions John Lennon. And I was sitting with the writer and the director in a coffee shop and we're, you know, going over the script. And I was like, John Lennon, is that Lennon, the guy from the Communist Party, right?
Oh, my goodness.
And he's like, no, John Lennon from the Beatles. I'm like, who's John Lennon? And, you know, and I'm not saying that it's impossible to live in a world without that knowledge, without knowing that. I mean, I've lived that life for 21 years, and I'm alive. I didn't die from not knowing who John Lennon was and not knowing what Star Wars is. But, you know, it's very difficult when you go out in the world, when you decide to leave and you want to live in that world. I mean, you almost can't have a conversation with anyone because they're going to say, may the force be with you. And I'm like, excuse me? You know, I don't know what they're talking about.
Does your family know you're doing this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my family knows I've been... My family found out that I was not religious before I actually left, and that, which is the reason why I got divorced, because I was already non-observant, and my wife at the time gave me an ultimatum. She said, you either be religious or you leave me. And I said, well, I'll leave you. And when I got divorced, kind of like sent shockwaves throughout the community because I come from a very prominent family. And
your father's a rabbi indeed, wasn't he?
Yes, my father is what they call a Hasidic Rebbe, which is R-E-B-B-E, which is different than a rabbi. It's more like a spiritual leader. Yeah, so my family knows. My parents immediately cut me off after they found out why I got divorced. But I'm still very close with all my siblings. I mean, most of my siblings.
So, Brad, you know, obviously this sounds absolutely fascinating. Where is Shundan Development now?
We are currently in discussions with several networks, and we're hopeful to get a positive answer relatively soon.
Loser, we have just a minute left, but I was interested to see that it's a goal of yours to win an Oscar one day. Is this your first step, you reckon?
I want to thank you for giving me another first. I can say now, my first live interview. And
my
it
pleasure.
Is, you know, yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, it's every actor's dream. And, you know, I found something that I'm really, really good at. And I just want to be better at it. Like everything I do in life, you know, I want to be the best, which is why I left the community, because there are things that I want to do and I want to do them well and I want to do them without any, you know, constraints that come from, you know, stupid ideas like God and, you know, and that kind of stuff. I want to be able to just, you know, go out there and do it fully.
Well, I'll leave that one alone and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lou Zatorski, he's, among other things, a newly discovered lover of bacon and one of the potential cast members for the show Shunt, which is in development right now. Brad Rothschild is one of the producers. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
After our conversation with Brad and Loser, we discovered that the network that originally expressed interest in Shunt has since passed on it. So what do you think of the idea? Is a show about former Orthodox Jews living in mainstream America something you'd like to see on the small screen? Enough already with reality TV's depiction of subcultures? Do you consider reality TV to accurately reflect reality in the first place? Let us know at wordofmouthradio.org. And who knows, maybe your thoughts could stir up interest from another network and get Loser one step closer to that Oscar. But first, we're going to go back in TV time with Free to Be You and Me, the multimedia project created by Marlo Thomas in the 1970s that challenged the way little girls and boys view gender, the women's movement, and even whether it's all right to cry. We're going to consider its influence 40 years later. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. 40 years ago this month, Free to Be You and Me broke ground in the lives and minds of children across America. The brainchild of actress Marlo Thomas, the project included a best-selling book, a Peabody and Emmy Award-winning television special, and an album that won a Grammy and went gold several times over. If you were a kid growing up in the 70s, you could probably still sing along with it today.
In a land where the river runs free.
Free to Be encouraged kids to challenge gender and racial stereotypes in a series of songs and skits voiced by an A-list cast, including Alan Alda, Carol Channing, Rosie Grier, and Marlo Thomas herself. Joining us to talk about how seismic a shift was created and how the Free to Be legacy lives on today is Laura Lovett. She's professor of 20th century U.S. women's history at University of Massachusetts Amherst and co-editor of the new book, When We Were Free to Be, looking back at a children's classic and the difference it made. Laura, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
Briefly, tell us about the origins of Free to Be You and Me. Why did Marlo Thomas, who I knew along with millions of TV watchers as That Girl, take on this project?
Marlo Thomas had been one of the first female television producers in That Girl, and notoriously That Girl broke a lot of gender roles. In fact, she was famously unmarried, both in the television show and in her own life. She was also the aunt to a niece and found herself really surprised when she tried to find some nighttime stories for her niece that reflected some of her ideas around gender. And that sort of led her to decide that she really needed to remake what children saw and heard.
So it was tremendously popular, won a lot of awards, as we mentioned, but it was also a product of the women's movement, and there was plenty of pushback and critics. Can you tell us about some of those complaints?
Some of them were about the broader vision of creating what was called a non-sexist movement. And so, in fact, socialization, the notion that, in fact, our gender roles are learned, was really seen by a group as an attack on the way that they thought boys and girls should be raised. And so the vision that, in fact, you could reimagine gender roles seemed particularly threatening. Other groups saw it as really kind of an attack. Gene Stafford of The New Yorker famously called it humorless bunkum and the inflexible piety of the Ms. Manifesto.
And the Boston Globe magazine warned parents against it. Don't let your children watch this.
Absolutely. Ms. Stafford, on the other hand, actually saw it as a little bit too focused on not disrupting the heterosexual nuclear family enough.
Well, let's listen to some of the songs themselves to hear how direct the message was. Here's Parents Are People. This is written by songwriter Carol Hall, sung here by Marlo Thomas and Harry Belafonte.
Mommies are people. People with children. When mommies were little, used to be girls like some of you, but then they grew, and now mommies are women. Women with children, busy with children and things that they do. There are a lot of things a lot of mommies can do. Some mommies are ranchers, or poetry makers, or doctors and teachers, or cleaners or bakers. Some mommies drive taxis, or sing on TV. Yeah, mommies can be almost anything they wanna be.
Well, they can't be grandfathers or daddies. Daddies are people.
So Carol Hall writes about it. She has an essay in the book and says that her children's views about gender helped shape that song. Talk about that.
Here she was a writer and really wound up challenging sort of her own idea of what she could do. But, you know, was making a living as a single mom with two kids, successfully writing. And her son was really surprised that she could write. In fact, he didn't understand the song suggesting that boys could be something besides doctors and the girls could be something besides nurses. Her daughter objected to her using the word women, in fact said that she should use ladies because ladies just sound so much nicer, and we all know that everyone is a nice lady.
Uh-huh. Well, you've been using Free to Be as a teaching tool in classes ranging from the history of childhood to gender. I'm wondering how your students, college students, are reacting when they hear songs like Mommies Are People.
My students, I came to this project because I began teaching this in a big survey history course, and I was trying to find a way to make students understand the impact of the women's movement, and I thought this was a kind of nice piece. And what I found was for my students, it was absolutely revelatory. They thought it was contemporary. To many of them, it seemed as if it were written just, you know, at this moment, because we're back to a moment when I think children have kind of pink and blue targeted at them. And my students were really surprised at the kind of the funniness, at the clever attack on media assumptions about roles and gender roles. It became something that I would play the CD in class, and typically some student would ask to borrow it, and then I would never see the CD again because it would get circulated around the dorms, and I'd have to go buy another one. So I think they see it as really kind of a contemporary comment.
We're talking about the legacy of Free to Be You and Me. That's a record, a television special, and a book created by actress Marlo Thomas in the early 1970s. Our guest is Laura Lovett. She's co-founder of the Journal of the History of Childhood and Youth and co-editor of the new book, When We Were Free to Be You and Me. Here's a clip from Housework. This is another song and skit here performed by Carol Channing.
You know, there are times when we happen to be just sitting there quietly watching TV when the program we're watching will stop for a while, and suddenly someone appears with a smile and starts to show us how terribly urgent it is to buy some brand of detergent or soap or cleanser or cleaner or powder or paste or wax or bleach to help with the housework. Now, most of the time, it's a lady we see who's doing the housework on TV. She's cheerfully scouring a skillet or two, Or she's polishing pots till they gleam like new, or she's scrubbing the tub, or she's mopping the floors, or she's wiping the stains from the walls and the doors, and she's washing the windows, the dishes, the clothes, or wrapping.
40 years ago, I mean, we could be seeing this today. As many men as I now know sharing childcare responsibility or being stay-at-home dads or, you know, stay-at-home makers, there's very little representation of that population on television.
Not only that, but it's a critique of, you know, what we do see and what gets normalized then as normal roles. In my graduate women's history course, I often sometimes get a really mixed reaction when I ask my students, who are all in what they think of as very equitable relationships, who winds up doing the toilet cleaning.
Now, you wrote a piece for the book on play and the role of toys in shaping children's attitudes. Let's hear. Now, this is the song that speaks to this on the album. This is William's Doll, performed by Alan Alda.
When my friend William was 5 years old, he wanted a doll to hug and hold.
A doll,
said William,
is what I need to wash and clean and dress and feed. A doll to give a bottle to and put to bed when day is through. And any time my doll gets ill, I'll take good care of it,
said my friend Bill.
So in this song, William's dad refuses to get him a doll. In the end, his grandmother buys him one, pointing out that he may be a father one day. How do kids who have grown up to become parents, I mean, how has it changed attitudes about gender roles that we impose on kids?
Well, we have changed our notion of what masculinity is in terms of fatherhood. It's really unusual now to imagine a father not being at the birth of a child, for example, or able to take care of a baby, maybe to change diapers and to help. And so I think we've really kind of reimagined what those roles are. But we also live in a world where sometimes it's very hard to entirely see that. One of the contributors to our book is a woman named Cheryl Kilo Davis, and she published a book called My Princess Boy, which talked about her son who liked to dress in beautiful dresses. He was 4 or 5 and just liked to express himself. And you know, she began with a conversation about the fact that her son was carrying a pink backpack. And another little boy commented on it. And actually, the boy said, oh, isn't that beautiful? Right? It was the boy's father who said, how can you let him carry that? So I think that, you know, while we have changed some of our ideas, I think we still have a way of reinforcing certain traditional ideas.
Laura, we have a minute left, but I'm thinking that in addition to reframing notions of gender, reading this reminded me of the emergence of a very kid-centric culture. I mean, many people were faulting the women's movement, second-wave feminism, you know, active in the 60s and 70s, with leaving the family behind and child-rearing behind. Free to Be sort of debunks that for me.
Absolutely. I think Free to Be is one of the three major texts for the women's movement. And we often forget that this was really a central piece of it. In fact, it was based on initially the fact that Ms. Magazine, from its very inaugural issue, had a series called Stories for Free Children. And very much a vision that, in fact, we needed to support the family and to really kind of reimagine family as we reimagined roles for women and for men.
Well, Laura, I want to thank you for joining us as we listen to Rosie Grier, former football star, singing It's All Right to Cry. I thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Laura Lovett, along with Lori Rotzkoff, is editor of When We Were Free to Be. It's a collection of essays providing a retrospective look at the origins and the messaging and changes brought about by Free to Be You and Me. Laura was with us from New England Public Radio in Amherst, and you'll find links to more on the book, including a series on Slate.com that was inspired by it, at wordofmouthradio.org. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. While prepping for this segment, we discovered that Free to Be You and Me is one of those things you either know or you don't. Did you have it as a kid? Did it change the way you look at and teach your own kids? Especially if you have a boy who's always wanted a doll. We'd love to hear your comment on our lively conversation now taking place on our Facebook page.
Sad and grumpy, down in the dumpy, snuggly, huggly, mean and ugly, sloppy, slappy, hoppy, happy, change and change and change.
Thanks so much for joining us today for our journey across this land that's your land. For more on anything you heard on the program, you can always head on over to wordofmouthradio.org.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and from all of us at Word of Mouth, it's all right to cry or listen to the radio.
It's all right to feel things, though the feelings may be strange.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Zach Nugent,
Virginia Prescott,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie.
With web support from Sarah Plourde.
Andrew Perella, that's me,
provides technical support.
And Dan Kogan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR.
It's Board of Trustees or its underwriters.
That's right.
For information about the show, to subscribe to our podcast, post a comment, or to read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Or join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
You can also follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
I know some big boys that cry too.